same thing happened as in Ulysses. Laylas now resisted to move to Priam, and the same with any other game. They had to always accompany money and the time is fast, and that time she had fast, and they came, they could gain in court, I think that the most important one that we put in there, the one that says that you can't issue a compliance call if there's a legal proceeding. And if the claimant is definitely in terms of Section 2, you can't, I think, come in and issue it. If it's a normal issue, technical amendment, that's the issue. And the last one is the exclusive jurisdiction of the legal court. In terms of all the sections all the sections that are not criminal sections, those sections that are civil, where there's fines and the same in the whole issue, but where there's a criminal element that is going to be not to court, not possibly charging the person, these areas will be building on the civil, and making clear that the legal court is constituted to the position to deal with all the issues. And the next area of the members is defined as the penalties themselves, increasing from range from 3 to 6, which presently is clear, and they were increasing to 6 years. And the last one is amount, the maximum amount that you can pay. He was having a grant, the employee now is increased to 12,000, and the 600 members of the group is going to be. That's the basic question of the government has.
Seems to me as if you feel some going to the NCUP, similar to going to jail. look at the shirt that you just made today. But we hope it won't be a good Sunday.
We support Baka as we got no objection.
Okay, thank you very much.
We support everybody, do everything but see the idea, otherwise we don't come back to us. So let's do that.
Thank you. Another until we finalize all of them, if you want to allow us to check the fashion that are similar to all the questions.
Let's move from my question.
Thank you. The ballot was passed. Yeah. After this. Yeah, it was very difficult.
I don't have to
kind
of quality to do it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Calm before the storm. You must wear it, you get what you wish for.
Thank you.
Employment equity.
So, the way to go is to come from where we should be known for. We don't have our case like this, which is that in the United States that there was no public education. I just hope you are not going to take a break and say to me. So that is my suggestion. I wanted to agree on this one before we move on to the legislation. What do we do? I can always say what my on hearing for our opinion is I'm saying if there is a contrary view or some other further motivation for that people, if not so, then let's delete this as a wonderful discussion of public hearing on both of the statements. If the committee decides that this thing does not necessarily need that much public participation, that's on us.
Chair, I believe that public education needs the opportunity rather than to pick up the opportunity in public hearings of this country. So I'm fully support your idea that we can go out and put us forward for public submissions and that we receive what they
that is the one. No, that's it. If you can move 8 seconds, that's good again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me say that.
Chief, I second that motion.
Let me go to the public hearing.
LRA. Yeah. This one is the easiest one. We show everything. Then we'll be disappointed if there are any disagreements on this one. As we expect a disagreement on the PCA. I think clause number one, I think that this clause is doing two things, Chair. With all the sections that I include in 8, it's doing basically two things. It's introduce a test for Section 21, organizational rights for trade unions. It says two things. One, when a commissioner, remember organizational rights, basically, you go to the commissioner for organizational rights, and the commissioner determines whether they're entitled to those organizational rights. Section 21 says, in taking that decision, the commissioner must consider the extent of atypical employment in that sector. For example, the commissioner would be able, in terms of this amendment, to say, well, we accept that you represent 10% of workers in this sector, let us say the security. And the commissioner would say, under no circumstances, we don't see that you are entitled to the rights in Section 21. But because of the prevalence of atypical employment in the sector, the commissioner would say 50% of the workers in this sector are employed through labor broking, fixed-term contracts, difficult to organize. Therefore, we will give you those rights purely because there's a high percentage of atypical employment in the sector or in that company. It could be the company, for that matter. It could be the company. It could be stop a checker. If the commission is of the view that the extent of atypical employment is very high, it affects the ability of the union to organize. Therefore, the commissioner could grant those rights even if the representative is low. That's the first thing that Section 21 does. It introduces that additional test. There is already a test in terms of the law as it is. It introduces another test that the commissioner needs to look at. That's the first thing. The second thing Section 21 says that unions that are not majority can still get the right in terms of Section 12, access to workplace, in terms of Section 13, reduction of stock orders, in terms of Section 14, representative shop steward, shop representative, in terms of Section 16, access to information. Section 16 deals with disclosure of information business. Now, the section says a minority union can approach the CCMA, and the CCMA, under certain conditions, can grant access to those rights. That's the major principle of clause one of this bill. Reason two things. It says when you decide, first, when the CCMA decides whether a union is entitled to rights, it must take into consideration the existence of temporary employment workers in the sector. How prevalent are they in the sector? Because there's an exception by all parties that it is difficult for trade unions to organize in a sector or in a company where there's a high percentage of vulnerable workers, temporary, system contract, labor broking, whatever it is. Therefore, the commission must take that into consideration. Secondly, that a union, a minority union, presently a minority union does not have avenues in terms of law to challenge and enforce to get those rights. Does not have avenues. The law says if you are this, you get these rights presently. If two parties, if I'm the majority union, I'm a majority union, and I enter into an argument with an employer for union rights, and we enter into that agreement, and that argument says that you can only come in this company if you are 50%, for example, or 40%. That's the threshold that is set. And then he organized the same company. I've got 40%. He organized the same company. And he gets 32%. He can't get in because he got 32%. He can't get 40%. The agri says he can't get in. The threshold is there. Now, in terms of this legislation, is that he can go to the CCMA and argue that that threshold is unfair, whatever it is that he argues. The CCMA, on the basis of the information that is given the commissioner could, I mean, you need to be very careful of it, the commissioner could grant him the right to enter. That's what Section 1 is doing. It's not giving automatic rights to minority reunions, no. It's giving avenues for minority reunion to be able to tap on in order to access those rights. Understand the difference? The law still gives rights to majority unions. Majority unions still have got the rights. But the amendment is saying that if a minority union believes that the threshold that has been agreed is set in order to block entry on the other party, the unfair on whatever basis it is, then we can challenge that. And the CCMA commissioner will be able to grant those rights irrespective of the threshold. What are the principles in Section 21 that's agreed upon? It's not proposing to do away with majority trade union. It's proposing, it's just like saying that if you've got water in a house, it's far better to open the door for the water to go out than keeping the water inside because it goes brown. And this is what it's doing. It's opening the door for minority unions who are aggrieved either by threshold or by the employer's refusal to give them the rights that are in the law, that now they can go to the CCMA and argue for those rights. And the commissioner has got the right to decide in an arbitration to grant or not to grant on the basis of the steps that we said that they need to look at in terms of the law. I'm suggesting that we hold on this so that if there are any questions on this, it was a very important area. Now, in this area, there's an argument with all the parties that make like a business. BIMA says in this area that they support majority trade union. This will make trade unions very weak, and it will introduce multiple trade unions. And they argue it's going to be costly. You were there in the public hearing when they argued that the issue. But all the other trade unions are happy with the proposal, and all the other parties. I'll take questions on that.
Do you remember when we first convened as the Union Committee of the Portfolio Committee of the we agreed to meet our push for people in the country to elevate the country to the level of the rights of workers to that level, to that level. And the intention of this is to say, we can do this through giving all workers a chance to belong to trade unions and to organizational rights in the working place. And that is the specific intention. That is the intention of the own act, exactly to do that. We can look at that as examples. Let's look into the official index. It has become a skill. And most of the people who work at SAA work as contractors and subcontractors coming from other companies. The other companies work for the airline. And most of these people are there on temporary basis. Paid by those companies, which then reduces the number of full-time employees of the aviation industry, because the rest are subcontractors and the majority of them are temporary people. Then all ATC people put in pilot. But between the pilot and the ATC to air traffic control, there are lesser air traffic controllers and airport than the pilot. But do we say that we cannot recognize the more million of less than 20 people? We deny them rights because they are the air traffic workers union, if there is any such union, or the association does not have 50% plus, so that they cannot be recognized. But if they go on strike, they won't be any aeroplane flying in this country. Because most air traffic controllers are pilots, and not all pilots are air traffic controllers. So, fewer there might be, they could don't have a very negative impact on the aviation industry in this country and beyond. Because the AA is linked to other, it's part of the star, which is the biggest airline company. So I'm just trying to show how important it is that even if people are retired by one, they can have a very negative impact on the industry. So the best way of ensuring that we deal with the collapse of the aviation industry, a lot of it, we need to give the people recognition, give them organizational rights. And this work will help us in certain times so we can use it. Over to you, Honorable Members, let's see how we can take on the board.
Are not sure whether
this integration with the fire last year is with collective bargaining. That's the first point. The second point is also to a section that we have not yet dealt with, but we are going back. I think it's section 23 that deals with collective bargaining. There are also matters that are looked at as to how does parties enter into collective bargaining, what procedure, how are they supposed to be looked at. I'm just raising this just for also not only for the department of us, also for us to take those factors in the process. The last one is, if at the end I'll be persuaded to agree with this kind of an arrangement, is in a way one for the realization of the freedom of association in terms of the constitution, and at the same time, it will be a way of nullifying collective agreements that might exist in terms of the same labor participation. I think Mr. McCarthy will be able to clear my confusion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chibosir. Yes, I don't know if this is a question or a statement, but I'm just going to say it. This amendment, I think we've seen what happens when there's a gap between organized labor and unorganized labor. And this amendment would close that gap, giving the opportunity for unorganized labor to be organized. And I think it's very important because if you think about an organization with that's got organizational rights currently, they might have the majority of the workers, but that majority could be 50% of one person. So there's another 9% of the employees that aren't represented by anybody, and it causes problems in the workplace. So I think we should bear in mind what problems can be caused by a massive group of unorganized workers and how difficult it is to engage with them. From the side of the employer, if unorganized workers go on a wildcat strike, it's very difficult to engage and to deal with that problem. But now this gap, amendment would close that gap, and that is a union could form there, and it would be much more easy to engage with the workers.
Thank you.
Thanks
for those
questions.
Can you what the future would look like?
Right.
Thank you. Are there any comments from the member?
Just also, and I will certainly ask a question. Does it mean that despite an existing agreement, the CCA can overrule that agreement? Yes. Can they overrule that existing agreement and declare that non important? Thank you.
I'm happy to.
I think that the easiest part of this question is the one where we are asked whether do we still stand by this agreement. The answer is yes. We believe in the bill that we put in the position. We believe they are good for business. We believe they are good for the coin. We believe that they are good for, they meet the requirements of the Constitution. They increase the possibility of workers to be able to engage collectively with their employers. Well, business has not come back on us and say, well, in view of what has happened, we now think that in hindsight, you know, sometimes hindsight is a very, they have not come back. But there's been statement by business leaders that we've all read in the paper where they indicated that it seems it does make sense to allow minority. We've read those statements, but formally they have not come and they don't cater to issues. Now, this action does not deal with that. It's got nothing to do with the agreement between the other parties. I go, I'm a green party, I'm a minority trade union. I believe that the threshold that is entered is unfair. Or I'm a minority trade union, I want this right from this company. The CMA can only give me the right. They are not nullifying the other agreement. I understand they can only decide whether my case is fair or not, whether I've made a case to get these rights. Therefore, they're not nullifying that agreement. That union has not complained to the CCMA about rights, everything. I made the complaint. The CCMA is making a judgment. The judgment is about whether can I get the rights in Section 21, all of them that I've put on. And the CCMA makes a ruling and says, I'm entitled to those rights. Therefore, it means I'm entitled to those rights. That agreement still remains of the two parties. It does not interfere with that agreement of the two parties. It's determining whether in terms of law I've made up a case to be entitled to the rights that the argument says I can only get them when I reach a certain threshold. Therefore, the law doesn't say anything about that argument. Secondly, in our legislation, there's nowhere where we talk about collective bargaining, the right to collective bargaining. It doesn't exist. The right to collective bargaining doesn't exist. Even if you're a majority trade union, an employer can refuse to negotiate wages and working conditions with you. Nothing in the law. We can't go in the law and say, well, you're acting unfairly because you're refusing. The law says, well, if I'm a trade union, majority trade union, I want to negotiate wage increases in this company, I put the demand, the employer ignore it. Mine is to declare a dispute, go to the CCMA, enter into industrial action. Therefore, in the law does not deal with the right for collective. It does not give trade unions that right and say you can collectively bargain with your majority. If the employer refuses, you can do this. You can, if the employer does not accept your demand, you can go on strike. If the employer wants you out, you can lock you out. Now, Section 23 deals with the legal effect of collective agreement. It does not give you the right to collective bargaining, but it deals with the legal effect of collective bargaining. It says, then if there's a collective agreement, that collective agreement has got a legal effect. That's like any agreement. If you agree on something, that agreement is a legal effect. That's what Section 23 does. But what I'm trying to explain is that there's no duty to bargain in our legislation. Therefore, nowhere in our legislation you will see a section that talks to the right to collective bargain. Doesn't exist in the legislation. But it does explain the legal effect of collective agreement. And in our legislation, the right to collective bargaining is implied in the rights that you get through collective bargaining. Section 21 gives you short word. It gives all of those things that it gives you. Now, if you've got shop stewards that represent your employees, it goes without saying that those shop stewards are going to be used to collect the bargains on behalf of those members. But the law doesn't say that they've got bargains. If they want, they can sit and no bargain at all. If the employer doesn't want to, they can go out. Therefore, the proposal that we are making does not interfere with that power relation between the parties. That's the first thing. And the proposal we are making does not dilute majority trade unionism. It still respect and accept that majority trade unionism are B in terms of the law. But it goes further and says that there should be an avenue for those parties who feel aggrieved when they refuse those rights if they are not majority. And it's giving that to the CCMA. The CCMA, you can adjudicate on dispute and make awards on dispute around whether trade unions are entitled to this organizational right. That's what this amendment is doing. Therefore, it does not interfere with the right of the other party directly. It interferes in the sense that where the party says you cannot come in if you are not 50% plus one, the commissioner might bring in somebody who's 40% plus one. It interferes as far as party is concerned. But the agreement still says, it does not say that agreement is null and void. That agreement, because the parties have agreed on it. The parties that were created that agreement, it still applies to them. If the agreement says, I've entered into the agreement that says 50% plus one. Even if 50% plus one, that agreement applies. The employer can say, in terms of our agreement, we've agreed between the two of us on 50% plus one. You are no more now 50% plus one. Therefore, you don't enjoy those rights. The agreement still prevails. And whether the party will succeed in going to CCMA and say, well, I entered into an agreement, 50% was one, but I think I made a mistake. I should, whether they succeed in that, I don't know. But that agreement, what I'm trying to explain, the decision of the CCMA does not interfere with that agreement. That agreement still remains. It's an agreement between the two parties. The CCMA is only dealing with a third party that is affected by that agreement and making a determination around that party and say, yes, there is an agreement between the parties that says every year this is the threshold. And I believe that in your circumstances and the information that you put in front of me, that is answered to you. I'm ruling that you are entitled to this agreement, to this right in terms of Section 21. That's what the proposal on the table that you're making is trying to do. I think I've dealt with all the issues in terms of that it deals with collective bargaining, it clarifies collective agreements. The answer I've given to that is that.
Okay,
would you want to add?
Yeah. If I may also thanks, Chair, the impact of this amendment on the existing agreement. During the Marikana issue, where there was NEM and AMCO, we had to rely on a gentleman agreement with NUM, Solidarity, and WASA to allow AMCO to come to negotiate the table because there wasn't already existing agreement. And we had to do that because of the gap, the absence of this provision. If the three unions chose not to allow AMCO to come forward, we may have been in trouble as it were. But they understood our plight and they heeded our request that they should allow AMCO to come on board despite the fact that AMCO was minority. So the deal in Marikana, by and large, was dependent on the unions that had already written up the name, allowed AMCO to come forward. This takes away the proposed amendment, creates an avenue for us, for the law to allow this to happen and improve the commission.
We all remember how people react when they hear that AMCO, which was at the center of the conflict, was not participating in the negotiation. And the president didn't know that the laws did not allow them to participate because they didn't have a recognition. And people thought, no, the government must be crazy. How does somebody call it right? And those people are not going to work and yet you are not talking to that person because they didn't know. And but I think now we have accepted the impact of non-recognition of minorities. So we are remedying that situation. It's over to matter. Are we in agreement with this one or if not, are there some changes that we must have to or should we continue?
The smaller difference is the difference between the complete section of the case, the purpose of short of language, that's probably some kind of way to designate the first principle to just stop getting the whole transmission loop. What I can do on the first page, the first principle, actually you have to use the first principle of the website, you have to write it with the government
principle.
So the person stops, short of the semantic adverse version of the book on page 2. it didn't simplify it to get support. So one of the government websites has a full one, but the pictures were the first to send it.
The one thing is that all this is the one another.
It's fine. Yeah.
I can mail the form for to say what it means and to say it for the people.
We understand the territories.
Okay.
let's
the second club number two of the deal, it went two things. It's giving a right to workers who are employed by labor brokers, temporary employees. It's giving the right to workers employed by temporary employees. As temporary employees. It gives them the right to exercise their organizational rights. These rights that we're talking about, soft stewards and all of those issues. They can exercise them either at the place where they work or against their employer. Remember, temporary employees, let us assume that Honorable Williams will support labor brokers as a labor broker. He employs Honorable Nyakemba. And Honorable Williams' offices are in Sutton. He places Honorable Nyakemba in Pretoria in the Department of Labor. Now, he's a labor broker. He got a contract with the Department of Labor to supply employees at the Department of Labor. He employs Honorable Nyakemba. He places him at the Department of Labor. Presently, this is the problem. Now, Honorable Nyakemba, because he's an activist, comes in the Department of Labor. He wants to join a trade union, exercise his right to form, join a trade union. Now, the head of the Department of Labor president will say to him, no, you're not our employee. You were employed by Honorable Nyakemba. If you want to exercise the organizational rights, go in Sandton. Organize organizational rights in Sandton. You're employed there. If you want to have your speaker, you want to have your shop steward meetings, you want to have anything to do here, we're not denying you those rights. No, the law gives you those rights. All of these rights I talk about, we're not denying you, but you cannot exercise them here. You must go and exercise them in Sandton. That's what the law presently does. Now, the proposal on the table says, no, we need to correct this. Employees employed by temporary employment agents can exercise these rights, these organizational rights I'm talking about. They can make a choice. It's their responsibility to make that choice. Honorable Nyakemba should be able, if this amendment is passed, this amendment, should be able to say to the Department of Labor, doesn't matter who employs me. I work here in Pretoria in the Department of Labor. I'm going to exercise my rights here in the Department of Labor because that's where I work. The fact that Honorable Nyakemba is my employer, who's got offices in Sandton, is immaterial. I've got to be able to exercise my organizational rights. And I must exercise them here in the Department of Labor. Now the law gives them that option and say you can exercise the right either at the Department of Labor or at your employer, whatever your choice is. That's the principle of clause number two, first one. The second principle that clause number 3 introduces is this. The same Honorable Williams employs Honorable Nyakemba and put Honorable Nyakemba, place him with Honorable Hanare at Canal Walk. If he can say Canal Walk. Now, Honorable Nyakemba, wherever he goes, he joins the trade union, you know, forms an organization, joins the trade union. You know. Now, Honorable Nyakemba wants to go and strike in Canal Walk. Now, in Canal Walk, he works Shoprite. Now he's bigger team Canal Walk. PNP says, no, you don't have a dispute with me. He can go out, go to the mall owners of Canal Walk and say, this is nonsense. There's no dispute with me here. These guys are picketing here in front of Canal Walk. They must go and picket there on the other side of the N1. N2, N1, is it N1? N1. On the other side of the N1. So they don't have a dispute with them. They must not affect my customers. That's what the law president said. Therefore, they must go, you're not taking away our conditional rights, but they must go and pick it there on the other side of the N1. Now, the proposal in Clause 2 says, additionally, that when there's a discussion about picketing rules between Pick and Pay, Checkers, and Honorable Nyakemba to introduce picketing rules, those rules could affect third parties on condition that third parties have been given an opportunity to put their views. They come, it's a choice. If they don't come, it's a choice. But there's got to be a process where that discussion in the system about picketing rules, a notice about that discussion should go also to whoever owns that mall. It is red defined, the proper owner, the biggest property company in South Africa. If they own the mall, send a notice to them. On that and such a date, the CCMA, there will be a discussion on ticketing rules to determine the rules for a strike in a Canal Walk mall by these parties. You are invited to come and represent your interests. That's what Clause 2 does. That's 2 days. After the first one is doing, it gives workers employed by temporal employment agencies or employers or labor brokers the choice to decide where to exercise their conditional rights. Secondly, it makes picketing rules applicable to third parties. That's the part, that's what part one, there's disagreement on that part. As a tradition, we want to make sure that when you consider the deed, you remember what the parties of NEDLAC said. Whether they agree or disagree with the issue, you remember that. Business is against this, as you would remember from the public hearing. Labor, all the parties in labor support this provision. Clause 2, as I said, it does 2 things. It gives employees the right to choose where to exercise their occupational rights if they are employed by labor brokers. If you are not employed by labor brokers, there's no issue. It's an employer at the workplace. And it also gives the status of fixing rules to affect third parties. As long as those third parties have been given the opportunity to represent their interests. That's it, Alphonse.
Any comments? to say what? We can't record it now.
No, that was not so taking the bread.
So there is envy in the change of terminology, understanding and rank. Okay?
Yes.
I was asking whether should I read anything in the previous clause, remember that we understand the equilibrium, and this one that takes it as read. I'm not sure if I read anything in that, but I won't read anything. the next clause is dealing with the extension of collective agreement. Presently, you know, the law, Section 32, gives the minister the right to extend collective agreement, bargaining council agreement, basically. No other agreement extended except bargaining council agreement. And in Section 82, put on what the minister needs to consider when she decides to extend collective bargaining. Remember, in terms of Section 2, the minister can only extend collective bargaining to non-parties now. You're extending it to non-parties. Can only extend the collective agreement if the parties are representatives. That is the majority of the students, the trade unions represent 50% as one of the employees in the sector. The employers employ 50% plus one of the employees in the sector. In that case, the minister doesn't have a discretion. The law says if the minister is asked to extend, the parties represent the majority, no discretion. The minister must extend. That's what you members of parliament said to the minister. You said, if the parties are representative, we don't have a role to play. The parties have opted for a private regulation of their affairs. Let them do it, because they are representative. If they are not representative, then the minister has got the discretion. Terms of Section 2. And the minister, in terms of Section 2, must consider certain things. And there are only two things that the minister that Section 32 says that if the minister believes that if she does not extend the agreement, it will affect or it might undermine collective bargaining, she can take a decision to extend the collective agreement if new parties are not representative. She got a discretion. Now the amendment says four things. It says that parties, bargaining council, must have in their agreement procedures to deal with exemptions. That's the first thing it does. The minister can't extend this agreement if the parties do not have procedures to deal with exemptions. If I'm an employer, I'm not able, in the clothing industry, I'm based in KZN, Newcastle, and I'm not able to meet the terms of the agreement that the bargaining council wants to extend. When the minister extends the agreement, he's got to make sure that there are procedures for exemption for an employer like me in Newcastle. That's what the amendment says there. Secondly, it says the council should resolve this application for exemption within 30 days. Doesn't help me as an employer. If I apply for an exemption, for any provision, it might be wages, it might be overtime rates, if the council is going to take 6 months to deal with that application, by the time they give me the exemption, my business is gone. This provision says that they've got to decide within 30 days on the exemption. The second thing this provision introduces is that if the exemption is refused, you must have right to appeal against that decision. The people that are sitting in the appeals body cannot be the same employer that are party to this council. It can't be the office bearer. Notice I don't say the employer. It can't be the office bearer of the council that sits in the appeal. Because remember the competition here. If I'm an employer in the clothing industry, I'm an office bearer in the clothing industry, and then keep my competitor in the same area. I'm an office bearer. Now I hear his case of exemption in an appeal. There's no doubt that I might be inclined to refuse the application, because when he does badly in business, it's an opportunity for me to get a customer. Therefore, there's no solidarity in that area of business. There's no solidarity that says that if he's doing badly, therefore I should assist you to do well like me. When you do badly, it's an opportunity for me. Therefore, the proposal we're making is that office bearers of parties to bargaining councils cannot be members of the appeals body, where non-parties appeal or any party gives this exemption. The third area that we're introducing here is that presently the minister, if parties are majority, the minister said, there's no requirement for the minister to notify anybody. We're introducing a provision that says it might be a good idea for the minister to publish in the government gazette her intention to extend the collective bargaining. So that if there's anybody that wants to influence the minister otherwise, they might have an opportunity to do that. Especially where parties are not representative. Where parties are representative majority, the minister doesn't have discretion. But where parties are not, and the minister wants to extend, then the minister must inform the public. That's what this is trying to do. The next area that is being introduced here is that when dealing with representativity of bargaining council, the minister must take into consideration the extent of labor broking in the sector. If the minister is going to decide whether to extend this collective agreement or not, if the minister must be able to look and say, at what extent are vulnerable workers working in this sector? If there's let us make an example. If in this industry there's about 50% of the workers are employed by labor brokers or temporary employees, then the minister might be able to say, well, I'm prepared to use my discretion and extend this agreement, even if parties are 30% representative, even if parties are 20% representative, because of the existence of vulnerability, I'm going to be lenient on what sufficient representativity means. Remember, the law does not say what it means. It says that if parties are not majority, the minister might extend that agreement by using her discretion. Now it says, minister, in deciding whether to extend or not, you've got to consider the extent of existence of temporal employment in this sector. And the likelihood is that if the minister is going to say, because of the high percentage of temporal employees in this sector, I know that it's difficult for trade unions to organize in that situation. Therefore, I will extend this agreement, although the representativity is very low. That's what the law says the minister can do in this section. The last area here is that also the appeal must be determined within a specific period in terms of this. When a party appeals, as we said, that the council must have 30 days and the appeals body must also have 30 days to deal with appeal. Those are the things that are being introduced around the areas of extension of collective agreement by the minister. The first one is procedure to deal with exemption, the time period dealing with those exemptions. The second one is that office bearers of parties of council cannot be members of appeals body. The third one is the minister must publish her intention to extend a collective agreement. The fourth one is the minister can now also look on the existence of temporary employees within the sector in deciding whether to extend or not. And the last one is that also appeals must be done within 30 days. That's what those three deals with. It's about extension of agreements and those procedures. I'll pause. Clause 5. Or is it clause 4? Oh, clause 4. Sorry. Clause 4. In terms of the law now, is that the Registrar of Labour Relations can give a bargaining council a certificate of representativity. And this certificate of representativity last for 3 years. When the law was amended in 2002, the intention was that if we do a representativity test, we verify your representativity, the bargaining council of the parties, and we give you a certificate, and that certificate says you are representative. Now, in terms of this certificate is in law now, that the Registrar can issue the certificate. And use this certificate as, because if you get a certificate in January, the certificate is a form of insurance to the parties that says, if we tell a representativity and you are representative for the year, it doesn't matter what happened in June, your certificate last for that period of 1 year. Therefore, even if you lose a lot of members in June, you can still use the certificate that you got for that year. That was the intention of the certificate. Now you know the law. I mean, these guys are on my left. They look at loopholes in the law. Now, the law did not say that the minister, in determining whether a party is representative or not, can also use the certificate in extending an agreement. And that's what we correct in this one. We just say that if there's a representativity test that is done and the council receives a certificate, that certificate can also be used by the minister in determining whether the party is a representative. That's what Paul says. Because that was the intention in 2002, but that was not effected in terms of law. Now we've got challenges in that. The minister used a certificate in the present case that we've got on the closing bargaining council, at least the closing bargaining council, and one of the parties that want to challenge that agreement says the minister did not apply her mind because in terms of Section 32, even if the registrar issued the certificate, the minister must do her own verification if she wants to attend the agreement. And we say, no, that was not the intention of the law. The intention of the law in 2002 was for the minister also to use that certificate in deciding whether she extends the agreements or not. and that's the change that we're making in hope. It's a technical amendment, but it's around the issue of the certificate. Okay, fine. Now, five, it is an aim provision. Where we say that Barring Council may charge fees if they want for the service that they provide. It enables Barring Council to charge fees. And that they can only charge fees on services the fees that they charge cannot exceed the fee that the CCMA charges. The first thing is that Clause 5 says that they charge fees, if they want to charge fees, it doesn't say for what, in terms of all the issues that they are dealing with, if they want to charge fees, but they can only charge fees that do not exceed the fees that are charged by the CCMA, in terms of Section 115. If the CCMA doesn't charge a fee for anything, they can't charge a fee. If the CCMA charges zero fee, they can't charge one cent because it's more. That's the safeguard to ensure that bank councils don't go out and introduce all sorts of fees, because the CCMA is supported by fiscal. It's not going to charge workers fees to come in and on the service. And it says that, for example, there are sometimes services like training that bank council gives to employers and employees. If they want to charge a fee for that, they can charge a fee. Even on Section 1.55, if they want to charge a fee on those issues, as long as the CCMA charges a fee, and that fee is not more than what the CCMA charges. That's basically what that clause says. It enables them to be able to charge fees, and those fees cannot be more than what the CCMA is charging. Presently, the CCMA is not charging anything. Therefore, this is really academic. The chances of the CCMA charging fee are nil. The chances of the CCMA charging fee. We don't see, this as affecting anything in any way. But it's just an aid provision. If it comes in and the parties want to use it, they can use it. But as we say, safeguard is that they can charge more than what the CCMA is charging. Implication of that, the reverse of that is that if the CCMA is not charging anything, they can't charge anything because the fee can't be more than what the CCMA is charging. That's five. On six.
I'm checking this part. No, sir. I also want to be clear. Bargaining councils, if they are established, they must have their own constitution. How the bargaining council will be run. Now, there are fees that are paid by employers and employees who are party to the bargaining council in that respect. So the fee that I'm referring to not on matters of administration in that part of the country, but it's failed in terms of the dispute resolution mechanism. That's what I wanted to be clear on, whether now this amendment is in relation to that, not to other administration fees that has been established in order for the bargaining council to run this program.
Those fees that... those fees that Honorable Nyakema is referring to are not called fees in terms of the law. They are called levies. If you look at that section has not been changed at all. That Department Council dispute resolution levy, for example. And in many cases, it's a levy where the employer pays 10 cents, the employee pays 10 cents for a levy. Department Council levy, where the employer pays 10 cents, the employee, those fees are not affected. It's not the fees. They are not fees, in fact. In terms of the law, they are called levies. And they still the same. There's no change in that. These affect fees that are charged to basically employees, for whatever reason, for conciliation and arbitration, if they have those fees. It implies with that. Does not affect the arbitration of collecting arbitration fees, but they are called in terms of LRA as I said, levies. And they are not affected. There's no change around.
I don't know what you mean, but the main
conflict. As I've said, Chair, that there are no fees presently. There are no fees that are charged, and the CCMA doesn't charge any fees. There has been a discussion in the CCMA, nothing where it's coming from. There has been a discussion, a long discussion, and it has not gone through everywhere. There were people that had the view that shouldn't you put a fee to access CCMA? What is that one, access CCMA? Should you have a fee of what? 10 rand for application, and that is not sufficient at all. And the argument was that if you put a fee, the cases that are coming to the CCMA, people will think twice before they bring the case. They will bring real cases instead of frivolous cases. That was the intention, trying to deal with frivolous cases. But then the negative to that is that it might mean that if you don't have 20 rand, you've got a genuine case, access to justice for you is denied because you're poor. And on those basis, the CCMA, that did not fly at all. Therefore, there are no fees presently in the CCMA, therefore they are not likely to be fees in the Government Council either. Yeah. We need it before this election.
Oh, on the team of
men. Oh, the team of men.
No, yes. Who is not there? If I am a detective, if I may, any sort. And the next one that comes close is the look, we should make an effort seeing if within the day at all they could be influenced, but they may have chances.
The cheese one, but the strawberry jam was just in the strawberry jam.
So we will call them.
Motu.
I think this is a very important area. quickly. Finish with section 61 in your absence.
Yeah, but the office is back.
Section that deals with the right to track, and this is an area that has been well written about, debated, disagreed, but this section, clause 6, deals does two things. It requires paid loans to borrow before a strike. That's the first thing. Secondly, it restricts the possibility of technical challenges on strike by those who want to challenge the strike. In our legislation, the 1956 Act, you had requirements in that Act for a borrow before a strike. And that was changed in 95 when this new act came out. And the reason it was changed was that employers challenged the right to strike on technicality. Unions would be unable to go strike because of technicalities of violence. And as a result of that, a decision was taken to take out the requirement for a ballot into strike. Now, there was an argument in the negotiations at MEDLEC to reintroduce the requirement for a ballot to strike. And the rationale of this was that the reason the violence in strike is because many of the strikes are not necessarily supported by the majority of workers. And in order to try and deal indirectly with violence in strike, you would want to make sure that a ballot is carried that has got, that will show majority support of the strike. That's the intention of this proposal. And it does two things. It puts the requirement for a strike, and then it says a strike can only be challenged. And a strike can only be challenged by either certificate is issued, that's enough for the strike to be valid. If the CCMA issued a certificate. And that's what Clause 6 is doing. Introducing, basically it's doing one thing only, it's introducing the requirement for ballots and then say a ballot can only be, is good enough if a certificate is issued for the ballot, in order to avoid technical challenges on the conduct of the ballot. If the CCMA issues a certificate, then that ballot is valid. And the proposal is clear. There has been disagreement on the issue. Presently, the law requires ballot if the union constitution requires it. Therefore, the strike is regulated in terms of the union constitution. If the union constitution requires ballot before a strike, then that union must follow its own constitution. That's what the present law says. that a strike is determined by the union constitution. And this provision now said there's got to be ballot. And then it put a safeguard to ensure that that ballot is not, there are no technical challenges on that ballot unnecessary. There's disagreement at NetLeg on this issue. Labour, all labour formations are against this proposal. Labour supports the proposal.
Bringing this back to stop labour violence so that we get a ballot to show the majority support, etc. Is there some mechanism to stop the ballot process from going on for months and months while the union is fundamentally deadlocked with the employer? So I want some clarity around the certificate and how quickly will the certificate be issued? Will the employers going to obviously try to avoid a strike and take dodgy actions to try and avoid the strike? So it's very complicated if the only reason that they brought this legislation back again is to imply that the only reason there's labour unrest or violence in strikes is because there's no ballot. And I think that's a very flimsy excuse for that. So we need to somehow come up with an understanding of what will the environment in the workplace be between the deadlock being reached and the certificate being issued. Thank you.
Any further questions from the room?
No, I understand it too, because there is this thing in finance. A union is not organized because they've got 50% plus one. And a union is that they have 50% plus one. And that means about 40% dilution and that's the union. And when you go for this ballot, then you find that they also, among the 50% plus one, they only get 50% plus one. So in practice you find that they have the majority of the members who have voted for to go on strike. But the majority of their members of the employees, not respect, are not supporting the strike, or they are not probably because the 49% have not been published, it's very difficult to assess. But you find that it might also create a problem that if it's I'm liking that because if I can employ it, and I do what you said, the crossword remove for that particular level, it will create more problems. And if people are more angry, it might create more problems within that particular state. And that's highlighting that because they, that's a particular problem.
So what
I said
just
did. No, I just want to say.
Okay, clarity.
No, that's clarity.
So that we can make him in for the honorable
Premier Chair, I think the issue here raises it highlights the importance of the decision to Kenya. If we do pass the earlier section that we're going to recognize minority unions, it means the balloting will no longer be only with the 50 plus one. It will also include those people who were previously excluded. So the dynamics will shift. And so for me, this is a very good example of why it's important to bear in mind these things as we go along. Because if indeed there are big changes and the minority unions also have an input and a say, when a situation of striking comes, it's no longer only the majority union that will be concerned, it will also be those people who have bargaining, collective bargaining rights. So it's rightly important. But from where I stand, I believe we need to look at, yes, the balance we should come back, and how do we get to it?
Thanks, Chairperson. I think what's important here is why this piece of legislation has been put back. The argument was that there is violence when there is strikes because the members weren't balloted. And I don't think we should include the other sections of the Act directly with regard to this being this apartheid regime being put back into the this legislation being put back into the Act. We need to look at the causes of violence within labour unrest. Now, to say that I'm asking, has it been scientifically, has there been research on this? Is this the reason we have labour unrest, violent labour in striking, because we haven't got a ballot? Or is this just somebody just came up with this notion in order to make it more difficult for workers to go on strike? You see, my concern is that the employers will deadlock with the employer, and then there'll be this long process where we could have violence. So I just want to know what position of the department is on that. Thank you.
expenditure. I think the latter part that Honorable Williams raised is the one that came to mind for me too. That if in the Act of 1956 there has been always a section that deals with balloting when workers want to go to a strike. And then as a result of the Act of 1955, that part or section was done away. And now the argument of bringing this section of 1956 back to the amendments of 2010, it's solely the reason of dealing with violence. Because violence when the strike, that will only happen after the 1956 Act was amended to exclude the ballot. I think that's one second. I think the same act requires that for a trade union to be registered, it must have a constitution. Now, if a constitution of a well-established trade union, which has a certificate by the register within the department, is the proposal not to undermine the same constitution that the department is encouraging, that you can't just be trade union without any constitution. I think the last point I want to share really a response to the question that was raised by Honorable Hanau. In the war scenario of politics, these are the members of the trade union who have reached a deadlock, either with an employer, at a company level, or at a bargaining council. Now, this union, I think I want to link this with the discussions of Section 21 that we spoke about earlier, that you cannot exercise certain rights, then you must run to CMA. Now you have run to CMA, you have been given everything by the CMA as a trade union. Now, with that membership you have in that industry or that company, you decide to go as that if at the end of the day the ballot issue is part of the act, and that raising that is the point. What will happen to those who are not members of this election that has reached a deadlock with the employer and it has balloted, and the majority of those members are really much people or whatever area. Does that mean those who are not members of this trade union because they have not balloted and they also have to be part of the industrial action? Thank you.
Let's do this to Mr.
The first issue, shouldn't the ballot be secret? That's the first question that is now. Now, what is the secret ballot? What does that mean? That's the problem that you're going to have. What is the secret ballot? Now, when you start, if you say it must be secret, and then it means then I can challenge on the basis that it's not secret. And what is secrecy? And it becomes a big issue. It's not, there's no definition in the law, in any law, what is a secret ballot? Does a box If an officer has got a hole somewhere, it is enough. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that the reason we went away from the word secret, we didn't want to open this up to any challenges in terms of, is it secret enough? And then, where people inside the room, does that mean secret? I mean, those, all the communication that comes in with the word secret. And then that's a decision, that, the basis of that, precisely to try and avoid abuse of this. The word secret has not been included in the bill itself. The parties have taken the ballot. And in these days, there are new ways of dealing with ballot. Would an SMS message, I mean, the electronic balloting in these days, is a secret. When I'm doing it, I'm sitting in the chair next to him voting, would that be regarded as secret? And all those issues. About secret, the way that we put secret, what does it mean? We have to define it what secret is so that we make sure that there's no abuse. That's the issue. We've got no harms in the department with the word secret itself, except that we think that it might bring unnecessary communication and unnecessary challenges on, and the right to strike purely on the basis of whether was the bank secret or not. And then, it's for members to decide on that. But I mean, there's no principle objection on the issue except that thing that is not going to give us what we want in terms of this issue. The issue of abuse will come in somehow. Now, the issue of whether it should be the majority of the union members or whether it should be the majority of those who voted. In terms of the law in front of members of the department, we opted for the majority of those who voted. And in our example, I mean, this issue was raised by business. Business said, no, you should have a majority of union members. We said, no, we can't have that. And we said, in this country, the party that is ruling today, or even the party that is an official opposition today, it is not an official opposition today because it received lesser percentage than the ruling party of the people who are eligible to vote. It's because it received lesser percentage of the people who voted on the day. And the party that is ruling in the country is because it received the majority of people who voted on the day. Now, if it's good enough for a party to rule a country on the basis of the party of the members or of the people who voted on that day, it should be good enough for a trade union to be able to go out and strike on the basis of members who voted on the day. You cannot expect the trade union to force people to come to voting because if you say it should be the majority of the people, of the members of the union, it means that the union must now make sure that all the members of the union vote. And if they don't vote, they are not likely to get the majority of the vote because the majority, it wants the majority of those who voted, of the members of the party. That's the problem with that formulation that says the majority of the members of the union. Those who want to go to the mall on the day of the voting, not go to the meeting where the voting takes place, if it takes place in a meeting, can't hold the strike to ransom on the basis that they did not vote when they had an opportunity to vote. Just like I can't hold the country to ransom because I decided not to vote, to have a cry on the voting day and not go to the polling station and exercise my right. And that's the principle on the issue on whether should be it the majority of the members of the union or the majority of those who vote. How can we take out the abuse raised by Honorable Stephen? Well, that's the issue that was stated for it, for example. That's what the section dealing with the certificate 6446 trying to do. It's restricting the validity of the ballot to the issuing certificate only. If the certificate is issued by CCMA, that says that the ballot has been carried properly, they have a certificate. That's the only thing that is needed. That is an attempt to try and deal with abuse. The issue raised by Honorable Williams, that says, can we make sure that the ballot takes place quickly, that workers are not frustrated, you take a year to determine the ballot. It's simple. The amendments do not change the fact that ballots are a responsibility of the trade union. They are managed by the trade union. It's the trade union that decides where the ballot, when to ballot, how the ballot is done. That is not changed. Therefore, if the constitution of the trade union says our ballot will take a year, it will take a year. It's the union that decides that. The employer is not involved in how the ballot takes place. Therefore, there's no reason why the ballot should take a year because the people that are responsible for that ballot still the union. The law only says that there should be a ballot. That principle of the union constitution determining how the ballot takes place has not been changed. Now, the question that is raised by Honorable Kanyari is a very difficult one. Because what he is saying basically, he is saying to us, you say, the reason the violence is strike is because you believe that the strike is not supported by the majority. That's what he's saying. And he's saying, you say that to deal with that there should be a ballot. And he's saying, now, if a union is 50% plus one, it ballots its members, and 50% plus one of its members, which would be of the company, around about 25% of the company, vote in favor of the strike. There is 75% who either have not voted, or if they voted, who voted against the strike. Now, how does that deal with the issue of violence? You've got your ballot now. 25% votes for the strike, but 75% is not in favor of the strike. If that 75% does not try, the strike is not effective. There's going to be perspective for violence in that situation. That's my understanding of the question that he's raising. He's challenging the basis of introduction of this issue by saying that ballot will deal with violence. He's saying, well, even in this case, it's still going to be a ballot of the minority. That's what he's saying. Now, if it's the ballot of the minority, how does that solve the violence? It's a difficult question. I mean, it's quite correct what he's saying. We don't have an answer to that, except that we believe, I mean, in our wisdom, we said that we've got to do something about strikes and violence. It's not good for the country, not good for the economy. And we believe if union members vote and the majority of the union members vote against the strike, there is no strike. Therefore, there's no reason for anyone to force anybody. If the majority of the union members vote for a strike, there's likely going to be a strike. And in those cases, when union members vote for a strike, strike becomes peaceful. The clothing trade union, because the tradition in its constitution, it always votes by strike. And the strike in the clothing sector are rare, but they've never violent. And we have not had incidents of violence in the last strike in the clothing sector. If the ballot is constitutional, it's always ballot. And its representativity among workers is very high. Now, if you extrapolate that to a union, a sector like clothing, the tourism sector, the level of organization for the trade unions are very low. There's never been a ballot in that sector. And incidents of violence are very high. Every time there's a strike in the security sector, violence, people die. We have not done a scientific research on this, but the attitudes that I'm giving you in terms of the different sectors indicates that where a strike has got support of the majority of members of trade union, is likely to be peaceful. That's what we're saying. The question of whether does this not undermine the union constitution, it does not, because we've said that, Honorable Nyegema, that the ballot is still conducted in terms of the union constitution. That has not changed. Now, whether, as Honorable Kanera has asked, was in a situation where 75% of the workers in that industry do not support the fact, would that deal with violence? In our experience, is that when the majority of the union vote a strike, those who have voted also are bound by that decision. Therefore, even if they do not support the strike, in terms of principle of the organization, they support, they've got to support because a democratic decision has been taken. And when we count their percentage, at the end of the day, the support of the strike becomes more because they are bound by the principle of the organization. Whereas that will succeed in dealing with violence. That's an issue that we all got to debate.
Actually, let's not forget the focus here. We were discussing balloting. And the question of secrets of Maoran secrets, according to Mkali, that's another issue. I think this will depend on. The main thing is to agree that there should be balloting. And how it's going to be done, people can be done. SMS or the secret ballot or whatever, rather than prescribe, because if you prescribe, then you need to come up with definitions and their legal implications, and some of the technicalities can be used to find violence to return the strike. So just in that we shouldn't focus when we are.
I just needed to say, in terms of the issue that I raised about the secret ballot, that I'm glad to see that the ministry has applied this finally, because I raised it knowing that this is an issue, you know, who determines what stuff. But the point of it to me was that it's not about safety in these people. Those are the things that prevent that violence. So if we can find a mechanism of making those violence safe, that would be satisfactory. But there's another important issue, and of course it was thrown into the program in Khalid himself, when he raised the issue of the national vote. The national vote versus the labor nation vote. There's two different things to make those sort of vote. So we need to
my own view is that the thing of conducting a ballot, I feel uncomfortable if it is that linked to the Bible. I think it has to do with the legitimacy of the fact about whether that fact is really supported by the member. I'm from the free, I'm part of the 1956 organization. And a general union uses that particular process to mobilize its own members. Because it takes a conscience. So you mobilize your own members to understand why they need to go inside. And that process, you then deal with a lot of other problems, and in most cases, there's no violence. I mean, my own experience was that violence was always from the state and the other people who were opposed to the fight. It has never been the fighter. Sometimes the supporters of the fight who are not at the work state sometimes, I mean, if you make somebody who pay for it in the country, because for them to do themselves and me at the work state. So what I'm saying is that but my own view is that it has got to do with really the legitimacy of the state. Meaning that what I think is important is that people should not know how and who voted. People must know that there are simply people who voted, but I should not be identified that I supported the fact or I didn't support the fact. Because the truth of the matter is that there is intimidation. If people know that they really want to go on strike, and it's a dispute. It's a dispute between the employer and employee, and people are caught under the collar. And if we do that, I mean, the movement of the 50 states where people used to vote by hand, that movement towards the employee where people have got to have a secret ballot now, was as a result of that, about whether that particular ballot is really really the will of the people, or the will of those who could force those to vote in that way. Because if you vote incorrectly, I will deal with you after that. So my only view is that if there is a ballot, people must know that the following people voted. Among them, they are the result. But they should not be able to point out that if Kizza and Khalifa could have voted here, they would have won. And therefore, we are giving the Kizza and Khalifa because they are the cause why we are not a strike now. That's the reason why the issue comes to you. The third point is that here there is a dispute. I mean, general elections, everybody has the right to vote. But here there is a dispute between a particular union and a particular employer or employer organization. There is a dispute. And as a result of that particular dispute, people decide that we are going to resolve this dispute through taking, withdrawing our aid. And if we are going to, it's really the difference between the general elections and the as a result of that particular dispute, the members of the union are going to ensure that even those who are not members of the union are going to be affected by these decisions which we are making. So I think that the issue of who voted, whether it's the people who determine all the members of the union, they can have all the rights, but if I withdraw, I must be able to affect. Because it might be like a vote of no confidence. The fact that I refuse to participate in that, I might be saying that I don't agree. Because if I agree, I will go and vote. And I cannot say I, for that purpose, I stop being a member of the union. Because what my practice says is that for the purpose of voting on strike, if I don't vote, I cease to be a member of the union. And only those who vote become members of the union. That's where I got the problem. It's not my view, it's not just that these are the things which I think I've got a problem with. When the time comes to the basis of the union.
Thank you, Chairperson. So, basically, the Act was in place until 1995, the previous one, which had ballots, and then it was taken away, and now it's been brought back by the department because of unrest in Sprunk. That's what you said to us. We mustn't move away from that, right? The reason why it is in front of us is because you believe that violence in strikes happens because there's no balance. But you just said to us, talking about organizations, you said in the clothing sector, which is more organized than the security sector, there's less violence than in a more unorganized sector. So you'd argue that the more organized sector is the less violence there is, and it's got nothing to do with the ballot system. But you didn't argue that. Instead, you brought back legislation that was put in place to undermine people's rights to strike. Why did you say that? Also, when it comes to small, tiny organizations where there's less representation or organizations involved, and individuals set themselves up as a small group, not under a union name, and they also go into deadlock with the employer, how are they going to organize a ballot? Will the employer give them resources to do that? Or does this mean that the only people that can strike now, because legislation is passed, is people who are belonging to unions who have the resources to set up a ballot?
May I
Thank you, Chair. I didn't want to spoil the nice sunshine outside, but once I will agree with Honourable Williams, he says that the more organized the environment is, the better it is. I agree with him. The better the sector is organized, the better for each individual. How I read the science out there is unfortunately that people are starting to operate outside the organized structure. And that is what we must protect. We must protect the units for once, at least, but not first for the first time or the last time. I'm fighting for the good name of the units. As we've heard, business also supports units, strong units. But what we are seeing is people going beyond the confinements, if I may call it like that, of the law. And if we can do anything to rebuild trust in the unions, I think now is the time to do that. And if rebuilding trust means that we must set the people out there, that the unions, they act in a democratic way, then I think we must do that. So that is why I am in full support of the ideas put forward here. Because I think once we are able to show both the organized labor and organized business, once we are able to show that the people who are operating not only outside the law, but also outside of democratic principles, then I think we will be able to curb this new scourge of people just springing up and forming workers groups and so on, and don't work through the unions and don't work through the recognized negotiating forums that we have at the workplace. So we just consider that idea, Honourable, that we are actually here working in favour of unionism as a general principle. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure about this one, but when you say there ain't no sunshine outside, we're going to be. I recommend you listen to Billy Wheeler. It's kind of you. Are there any further input from the members?
I'm less worried about how it's going to I'm not dealing with the rules of this. The silence about the protection of those workers who are working in the same place because they have been brought in by temporary employers and then there is a strike and they also participate in the strike. I don't know why they are protected. They might be protected somewhere else, but I'm really worried about that. If you are worried talk about violence, that's one of the things I need to pay for violence. When I'm going there, but I do not protect and work as a rules of strike. And people are meditate, after the strike you have your job. After the strike I will not have that. Therefore I'm going to work. And then you will attack me because of that. I might be out of order, but it's in my head. And that's what I'm going to express by the community. And find a way of smuggling in different sports.
So that we don't lose focus, the discussion is on biology. At the same time, we talked about this relationship between the two boys, and they are talking to each other. When you look at the drive, the biology, and on the other hand, we've got recognition, the organizational rights in the very conditions of the family. But at union, I made an example with the air traffic controller. They are the smallest section within the aviation industry. But 19 of them, if they are 19, I'm just making an example. And out of the staff of about 2,000 people. And these 19 people, because they've got the recognition in the youth, the recognition with the employer, can be built their own. As air traffic controllers to say, we've got a recognition, we've got a lifeline with management, we want to be careful too. And we know very well that if air traffic controllers go on strike, no plane will fly. Mm-hmm.
because they are the ones who bend planes. Planes are not bended by pilots. Pilot has instructions from ATC on which direction, which speed, and which line to, including even docking. All those are controlled by the software. They are very, very important people. If out of the 18 of them, 17 of them decide that we need to go strike and let us know the others, they have their recognition. And we say we're going on strike. What the acts say, according to my understanding, is that the acts and control need to mobilize other divisions within SAA to say there's a need for a strike and this is what we're going to enable. And because this is what makes unions vibrant, because then you start looking at other people like this. You talk about consciousness of pride that workers have, that this is the time that we need to exercise them and this is the benefit of them. And those 20 people can actually convince the 2,000, close to 2,000 of them to go on strike. What we're trying to do with this is to say, it was their public participation in this process, was their buy-in, and how do you prove that there's a buy-in? You can only prove their buy-in through ballot papers, that out of so many people, this X number, which is the larger number of all the workers in this country, or in the airline, like maybe pursuant to the airline, have decided to go on strike. So that is what we need to produce. But now the workers in their meeting can decide what method are we going to use in this balloting process. We agree there should be balloting, but how are we going to do it? And if we are 17, I mean if we are 18 air traffic controllers, and all of us are dissatisfied with the conditions at work, we can decide that no, this can be the same. All of us are dissatisfied, let us go, we don't have to go get a box and have somebody in a truck officer doing the boxes and shading places so that people don't see who we want. They can agree in that meeting that we'll do it through the raise of hands, it's only 18 of us. But in instances where somebody feels no, let us do it that let us use the secret ballot system. It's fine, they can agree among themselves. I don't think it should be in the act to prescribe that this is what we need to use to get to that decision. Except that party is forbidden. That's my opinion.
I think, Chair, on this issue of secret or not secret, what we all must bear in mind is that the right to strike is a constitutional right. That's the first thing. Very important, the right to strike is a constitutional right. Any processes that limit that right has got to meet the test of the constitutional, of the Constitution. Now, the only thing that you're raising, when you require that a secret ballot be held, the first thing you are opening it up for challenge, technical challenges, on the secretness of the ballot. What is secret? Remember, there is in 1956, in 1985, we took out balloting. It's precisely because of technical challenge that prevented workers going out on strike by challenging the ballot. Now, that's what's going to happen when you put the word secret, because you're going to challenge it on whether it was secret or not secret. And I've asked a question here. If the union in its constitution says that we can have poster ballot, when people vote in their houses, is that secret? How does the union determine that it was secret enough is good? I mean, those are the issues that we need to determine when we put these words in. How would it affect the right of workers going back? And that's the issue that I'm raising. I'm not bringing an answer on that. I'm saying when we put the word secret ballot there, the chances of opening up a right to strike a technical challenge as it was in the 1956 Act because of the secretness, whether it's a secret, whether it's not a secret, how secret things need, what steps have you taken to make, and all of those issues. Then you're bringing back those technical challenges. That's what we're saying. We agree that any ballot should be on the basis of no fear of taking a decision. You should not fear taking a decision. The barometer should be such that you are able to take any decision, whether against or what. There's no threat on your life and your fear. We agree, but we must make sure that that provision does not interfere with the right to start. And secondly, repeat again, the right to strike is a constitutional right. If you require the majority of the members of the union to vote in favor of the strike, it's tantamount to say that the union should not go on strike. Because you're saying that whenever a union is going to take a decision, it must make sure that everybody there. Now, this meeting takes place because there's a certain quorum that is set up. The Union Constitution has got the Constitution that determines what happens if there's no quorum in a meeting. Even in that meeting of a vote, what happens? The Constitution determines those things and says, well, the meeting must stay adjourned for a week, and then what happens if in another meeting, when if they are not there, the Constitution deals with those issues of majority. But we of the view from the Department, if you require that the vote must be of the majority of the members of the Union, that would mean that restricting the right to strike, the ability of the union to be able to go to strike would be restricted, because I don't believe that there's any union that will carry a ballot, that has ever carried a ballot, and it can satisfy that the ballot has been selected by the majority of the members. Because many people don't teach up a meeting, they're not able to go to meetings for many reasons. And that's the second issue that was raised. On the issue of what happens to, does it restrict the right to strike if you are not have the money to do a ballot? In terms of the law, and in terms of practice, we never had legal strike in this country by non-unionized workers. We never had legal strike. Nothing that we've never had strikes by non-unionized workers. We've never had procedural strikes. Remember, when you take up a ballot to do this process, you are attempting to have a procedural strike. Union workers that are not unionized tend not to do those things. If workers have no union, there's more chances of unprocessed strikes taking place when there's no union. Therefore, workers who are not organized are not going to even go to the CCMA and conflation, declare dispute, to all of the things. Because, let's look at America. It's precisely because the union of involvement is not there, what's taking place there. Where does the union, you are more likely to see a union that's trying to have procedural issues followed. Therefore, in our experience, Honorable Williams, we've never in this country had a procedural strike done by members, by workers who are not members of the union. And those are the only people that would not have no processes on how to ballot and to hire a hall for a meeting, they would not have the money. And would never have strikes that follow that process for workers not in union. And this section says, talks to members of the union, because our whole ethos in terms of our legislation talks to organization and union. In every way that we talk, it says members of the union vote. The assumption, I mean, the experience I've said is that workers who are not members of the union are not inclined to have a procedural plan. Even if you say they must vote, they're not going to vote. That's why this section talks to organization. That's why all legislation is structured as. Therefore, it's not going to affect the right to strike. And I'm saying, in terms of practice, those workers don't, in any event, follow the procedure. Those workers who are not members of the union. That's why we need unions in order to ensure procedural strike takes place. That's why we need stable unions in order to ensure procedural strike takes place. And practice has shown us that where there are no unions, you are more likely to have unprocedural strike and wildcat strike takes place. on the issue that is raised by Honorable Nari about strike of action, the law as it stands now says, if I work for Jaga, Sakau carry the ballot, go to the PCMA, declare dispute, as everything that is in the terms of the law goes up for trust. I'm not a member of the union. I've got to interact in support of that. I'm protected as a law. I cannot be dismissed on the basis that the court has determined this issue. The employer tried it. It went to the court. It came to the court. It went to the Labor Appeal Court. It went to the Constitutional Court. All workers are protected. If the union strike is protected, all those workers working there, whether they are members of the union or not, they are protected if they suffer the strike. Therefore, there's no risk of members who are not union members who join a strike being dismissed because the legal jurisprudence protects them. The interpretation of the court of the law is that if the strike is protected, all the people that work in that company are protected if they join the strike.
Thanks, Chairperson. The department just said that they've never had a non-unionized legal strike, so they just said that. And the violence, the reason why we've got this section in the new act is because of violence in strikes. And in the main, it is wildcat strikes where the violence occurs. So the justification for your putting this section in is unjust. There's no other reason other than it seems to me trying to undermine the right to strike by which is fundamental. Don't you think this would be done in the Constitution by the unions? Thank you.
You can't be part of the team. I think you got to
challenge the Constitutional Court. Yeah, can be challenged. Anything can be challenged in the Constitutional Court. Whether they can succeed, that's something else. But anything can be challenged. We believe.
To say it can be challenged is all well and good. Sorry, Chippers, but I must say, because we don't pass legislation hoping that it doesn't get challenged. We pass legislation thinking about it and knowing that it won't be challenged. We don't just pass legislation and, oh, well, if it gets challenged, that's somebody else's problem. It's our problem.
No, what I'm saying is that we can't stop anybody challenging any legislation going to court. But what we're confident of is that the provision we put in this bill, including this provision, will stand the test. It will stand any challenge in the Constitutional Court. That's what it's saying. Therefore, members should be confident that if they pass this provision as it is, it will stand any constitutional challenge. That's what I'm saying. I'm answering directly that question. What I'm saying is that people can challenge the legislation. We can stop them in doing that. But we're confident that this will meet the constitutional challenge. That's what I'm trying to say. I'm not saying that no party does make a difference. I'm saying we can't stop people challenging it, but if they do, from our side, we're confident of it will stand its constitutional test. That's the issue that I'm trying to say.
And that is the issue that the number one is about the constitutional shortcomings of this. That's why we're having this meeting. Then we can say, no, we need to start with this here because it's at the tender. If somebody goes to court, they're going to lose it because it contrasts in whatever section you have to give them. And there is something called the intention or the spirit of the law. I don't know. There are those nice ways that the government could use. It talks about spirit and intention. But you just make sure that everything we do is hinged on the Constitution. And if we need, if it's possible, blue phone, we need to close it now by inserting security or taking other ways out.
Thank you, Chair. I think from our side, my colleague, Dr. Lewis, is actually in the floor and she will speak to the issues not But just on the voting aspect of what stands out, I think I get the point.
That's how good you're going.
That's right. That's been what you're going to I'm actually calling. The issue with voting, the primary concern is that I agree with the Honourable Member said, you know, when you look at votes on a national level as compared to what we do with the labour legislation, it's two different concepts. I think if we take a national vote and we put it in those steps, we sort of draw on the analogy. For purposes of this bill, I would say something, you had a national vote, and once that vote has been tallied, that translates into proportional representation in national assembly. That translates into committee representation, and I think some time back a couple of weeks ago, when we were deliberating on the basic conditions of employment, well, I think it was Honourable Member Taylor who said he voted on the day he voted being 25% of the members present. I can't remember a couple of weeks ago. And I think there were three or four members in the committee. And and so if a vote had to be cast on a day with the members present, we would have been able to take a vote. But that wouldn't necessarily have been what Parliament intends. That wouldn't have been in line with what a representation of the National Assembly intends. And but similarly to what stands out for me is that when we're giving opinions, we must remember that essentially it's about membership. It's not just about everybody in the workplace. You are a union member. And so when we vote, it has to be the majority of members of that union. Not necessarily the vote taking place on the particular day. Now, whether members agree with me or disagree with me, that's for members to decide. So I think we just have to be careful of that nuance. If we have the vote proceeding in terms of currently drafting the bill, what you have is maybe a union of 500 members, but 150 votes on a particular day. Your vote is determined by the 150 that voted, where that in itself is not even a majority of the membership of a particular union. But once again, that's not necessarily a legal issue, that is a policy decision, but I think it's a nuance that the committee members need to get their head around for when deliberations and voting does take place on the floor. But that for me just stands out. I think that we are still running regardless if a vote does proceed along the line that is suggested in terms of the floor. I don't know whether my colleague would just like to add certain other things as well. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I would like to conclude with Alice Gordon that a lot of the concerns here are policy-based decisions that are required. I noticed some of the concerns in terms of the meaning of balancing secrets and how far it goes, and that it comes from previous legislation and now being brought back. With Chair Kitson's committee's permission, I would like to go look into that and then just apply in writing. If we have some sort of comparison, perhaps to get back. If it's a way we know to find answers, but we don't fall around for encyclopedia of information in our heads. So with permission, I would like to respond in writing to some of the legal concerns that I just about the members.
Thank you very much.
That assurance
is it following the basic conditions of employment? What does it say about the political workers and the right to organizational rights? It is a protective in terms of that. Let it do, they cannot be discriminated for exercising the organizational rights. I just want to check if we are still together on that one, but make reference to the basic conditions when you answer.
I think that our colleagues from Parliament and Legal are correct. These are policy issues, not legal issues, they're policy issues, policy choices that Parliament members need to take positions on. It's not about whether to comply with law, policy issues. And then these are the policy choices that the Department has made. As members of Parliament, you've got the right, you pass legislation, not us, to make whatever change that you make. But what we're saying is that these are policy issues. And this is a very contested area. It's a very contested area. And as one thing, Labour is violently opposed to this proposal. Not all Labour. When I say Labour, I mean the Tosa Kosato, not to admit that. Not literal. Not literal. Not literal. Not literally. On the issue of protection, on the issue of protection, you're correct. It's clear that you remember, you know, the issue. But that is one mistake, you refer to the BCA. It's not BCA that solves the problem. It's this legislation. Section 21 talks to organizational rights. Remember we talk about employees employed by labor brokers, they can make a choice in terms of Section 21 where they want to exercise their conditional rights. They can exercise their conditional rights in Santin, when I use that example in Santin, or they can exercise their conditional rights here at the shop, right, where at the Department of Labor, that's an example that I made. Now the Department of Labor employees are out on strike. They exercise their conditional rights at the Department of Labor. It means that they can go on strike in the Department of Labor because it's the hour day. They exercise their rights. And secondly, without even this, the law as interpreted by courts has protected workers. If in the Department of Labor go out on strike, on a protected strike, and workers who work there, irrespective of whether they work for labor brokers, go out also on strike, the court has protected those workers against dismissal. Without the amendment, you don't need this amendment for that protection. The court has already done that. Therefore, there's no fear about protection of workers, irrespective of whether they're employed by labor brokers, whether they're employed directly by the employer. Secondly, Section 21 talks to that directly, in that they can exercise their conditional right where they work. If the strike takes place there, and one of the organizational rights is to be able to go on strike, and you go on strike, they be protected in terms of that.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. There's just two dimensions that have to be affected to this debate. The first one is when the Department came with a proposal of using the ballot as one instrument of many other instruments that needs to be explored to curb violence. And in fact what happened in the past is nowhere near the kind of dimensions and proportions of the word ambiguity at the time when we were placing the proposal on the paper. I think what would be useful is perhaps to tap into the wisdom of this committee into thinking about more creative ways of how to deal with this. Secondly, and most importantly, violence is not in the pay of the labor law. Violence that's put on criminality, which then begins to overlap
into a domain of the total dependence altogether. So we need to resist the temptation of being into labor law, criminal prevention instrument, or how you deal with criminality, bearing in mind that it's the jurisdiction of the total dependence. But I think the events of the recent past that say to us perhaps we need a better coordination between among various ministries when it comes to these issues, because we never thought that state action could be a trigger for someone. So we just need to bear that in mind, that we don't feel like we're putting before committee something that is not kept in our town. It is definitely the landscape that changed quite much. And then also the identification in terms of what the labor law can do. And also being mindful of not encroaching into other areas. So just bear that in mind.
I'm still okay.
It's still continuing like the one.
You save it here.